Welcome to Cinema Smackdown on TJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody, and I am joined today by Shane Simmons, a man whose greatest claim to fame is drawing dots. Thousands and thousands of dots. Shane,
in
tell us about...
In the madhouse. on my rubber walls.
Well, those rubber walls have been photographed and put into books. Shane, tell us about your collection of books starring dots.
Yes, they are called Longshot Comics. The first one was A Long and Unlearned Life of Roland Gethers. The second one was The Failed Promise of Bradley Gethers. And the third and latest one is called... what is it?
Don't ask me.
Oh, God.
It's on my shelf. I could reach for it, but it's...
Yeah,
it's
you might have
of,
to.
It's a bit of a ways away.
No, it's the... The Inauspicious Adventures of Filson Gethers. That's what it was.
All right. Totally worth the wait.
Total. Yeah. So, yeah. 3,840 panels of characters as dots and lots of dialogue per book.
I mean, but it's also a world-renowned, incredibly lauded work.
It is. I will say it as has actually been the subject of lectures in Europe. It has appeared in museums. And it has been reprinted in many languages at this point. So... a bizarre little graphic novel that some people know about and go, wow, that thing. Or as Rick Veitch, the back when he was drawing and writing Swamp Thing, he crossed paths with me and said, "You're the guy," but not in a good way. More in a, "Oh, you're the guy who proves that you can do epic comic books without bothering to draw them." I think he was a little bit offended.
Rick Veitch is a bit of a lovable eccentric.
Well, he didn't try to pick a fight with me or anything. He's just like, "You're the guy."
I once met Rick Veitch at a convention, and this is in the late 80s, because that's when he was doing Swamp Thing. And an uncle of mine accompanied me, and my uncle became very seriously interested in stealing Rick Veitch's girlfriend. He described to me kind of in detail the plan he had.
Did your uncle look like a swamp monster?
Some might argue yes, but that's another story. All right.
Those comic cons are they're hookup culture for nerds.
Apparently. We are off and running on the subject of dots and apparently bad people. Let's keep the subject of bad people running. Today's topic, we are going to talk about movies with clear good guy, bad guy characters where the bad guy gets defeated early in the film, and then you're supposed to believe that he is still a threat later on, which never works. There are many more examples of this than you might think. Shane, I am going to tell you how I was inspired on this subject now. This is a little story about how I came to think about this concept of bad guys who are essentially proven to be ineffectual. So I was inspired by this story I heard about William Goldman when he wrote Marathon Man, which was a novel and later became a celebrated movie. That's the Dustin Hoffman movie in the 70s with Roy Scheider and Laurence Olivier. So Goldman originally wanted the Nazi antagonist, the villain of the story, who is named Christian Zell, to be an intellectual, a doctor, and to have a damn good reason to come to New York City. The whole story of Marathon Man centers on this Nazi coming out of hiding to New York for some reason. So, we discover that Zell lives in Argentina. He has built his own little hideout in the jungle and protects himself and his work from the rest of the world. Now he must come to New York and collect the stash of diamonds that he stole during the war. When he was plotting the book, William Goldman decided that Zell would need heart surgery. The idea popped up when he read about Joseph Mengele, the Nazi doctor known as the Angel of Death, who needed heart surgery and had heard about a new technique being pioneered in Cleveland. That's real stuff. But for fiction, Goldman decided this was a damn good reason for someone to visit New York's best doctors and hospital. So the fictional Zell seeking medical surgery would be compelled to walk the streets of New York City and also become vulnerable to his old enemies. A short time later, William Goldman chastised himself for his stupidity. How could a monstrous Nazi doctor, hell-bent on harming anyone who stood in his way, be frightening if he was in fact a frail old man in need of medical help? Goldman changed the character, and Zell quickly became a sadistic dentist, a villain who enjoyed the pain of others and the power that his dentist drill wielded over his helpless victims. Every protagonist needs a strong antagonist, especially in a good guy versus bad guy movie. And with that in mind, that was my inspiration. I decided to look at films in which there are bad guys, clear bad guys, who get defeated early in the movie, but then return to continue to pester the hero. But by this point, all the air has gone out of any threat they might have had. And there are a lot of these films, movies I remember looking around the room and thinking, are we really supposed to be worried that this guy's going to win now? And I just have a little list of them. I don't know if you have any of your own that spring to mind, Shane.
Oh, some may occur as we go along, but I'm sure you have a substantial list.
All right. I'm going to start off with one of my favorite movies to rag on, the very beloved by people for reasons I do not understand, Logan, the film starring Hugh Jackman in his final, hopefully, appearance as Wolverine, a movie which it opens with him, you know, out of it, not happy anymore, aging, and you know, he's essentially dying if you've watched Logan, but he's trying to put in a, you know, one last good effort. So along comes this team of mercenaries who are sent to take out Logan, and they're led by a guy named Boyd Holbrook. Now Boyd Holbrook, he's an actor who's been around a lot lately. He's one of these pretty boys who they keep throwing into films like he's going to become famous, but it just keeps not working, at least not for me. He was the lead in the Predator film by Shane Black.
And, oh, him, yes.
And as far as I was concerned, he was a terrible choice. I had zero interest in following that character and hoping he would succeed. Well, in Logan, he's playing a bad guy, which I'm a lot more on board for. So Boyd Holbrook's character, his character's name is Pierce. And Pierce is leading a mercenary team. And they show up and they act all tough. And Logan kicks the living hell out of them. And then they don't die, or he doesn't die, and he is, you know, armored up again, and they fix him up, and they send him back into combat again later in the film against Logan, who kicks the living crap out of him. And this scene repeats right to the end of the movie. And I just remember thinking, why does this keep happening? Like, I'm not afraid for our hero at all. This guy is a joke. And I mean, there's a lot of other reasons to crap on the movie Logan.
Well, that's why Logan ultimately had to come up with another villain in the form of the mirror version of our hero, which is only what they do in every single Marvel movie ever. Yep.
The younger, better looking, stronger, identical version of himself, which, by the way, if you watch the movie Logan, they never explain. He just shows up at one point. No one mentions, oh yeah, we made this other version. No, I mean, we do have a doctor who makes creatures and clones and things, but they never outright explain why they have an adult perfect Hugh Jackman sitting in a tube somewhere. Never comes up. He's just suddenly in the movie murdering people. Suddenly there's just a big scene in the middle of the movie where Patrick Stewart is laying on a bed, and in walks young handsome Hugh Jackman for no reason, with no lead in, who then pops his claws and stabs him to death.
Yeah, and it was always a happy moment to know that that character went out thinking that his friend murdered him.
Well, I mean, to be fair, that's probably the most interesting plot point in that movie.
Yeah, sadly it is, yeah. I'm not a tremendous fan of the film either, even though it's a very critically lauded.
Yeah.
But
a beloved movie.
We have talked about the shortcomings on a number of occasions.
It was a head-scratching movie for me, because I do remember the movie Logan. I was sitting in a cinema with a friend of mine. The movie starts. I had no preconceived notions, no expectation, good or bad. I was just, I'll watch a movie. Let's see what happens. And then Wolverine, I think he's driving a limo around, and some people harass him and try to hurt him. And he pops his claws in the first 5 minutes and he attacks them. And it's the first time in any X-Men film where you really see him cutting people up. Like he's murdering them on camera, and it's really violent in a good way. It's extremely gratuitous, but it's very, very engaging.
It's the R-rated Wolverine scenes you always wanted to see.
And I turned to my friend who was very much invested in the movie. And I said, that's the best scene they've ever done in one of these movies. And it hit me even in the moment as I was saying it. Oh.
You should have made us wait.
They didn't save this. And now the movie can't get better. And, to build towards is really what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And then not only does it have nothing to build towards, it honestly has no message beyond that except sucks to get old. Oh, and Boyd Holbrook is a complete pussy. I'm baffled. I'm really baffled. That was one of those movies where I just kept thinking, I am not concerned with the villain ever winning this fight. I think at some point they also introduce, keep in mind, I saw this movie 5 or 7 years ago, whenever it came out, and I never rewatched it. So some of my information may be a bit vague, but they also introduce Richard E. Grant at some point as being some sort of threatening scientist character who is also no threat whatsoever.
Mm.
There's just nothing in the film that is believably gonna hurt the characters. It is also, as I joked way back in the day when the movie came out, and this is the biggest spoiler you can ever give for a film, it is the movie in which they tell you overtly that Wolverine has been a vampire all along because they dispatch him with a wooden stake to the heart.
Well, that'll do it.
I mean, let's be fair, a wooden stake to the heart will kill anything, but it was a very strange series of choices that led to that scene.
And well, that's probably how James Mangold plans to finally finish off Indiana Jones next year, too.
That's a very good point. I do look forward to my James Mangold-infused Indiana Jones.
If they could, A, patch Harrison Ford back together again to finish shooting that thing,
yeah,
and B, if James Mangold can stop fighting with people on Twitter.
As of this recording, Harrison Ford is not in good enough shape to continue shooting that film. We'll see.
He's done some additional green screen stuff, and apparently they're going to be deep faking a lot of this film. And wow. Yeah, it's going to be quite the cartoon.
I'm amazed that the final, I don't know, quarter of Harrison Ford's career has essentially been an apology tour of revisiting old roles and making them terible. One by one by one.
Remember when I refused to ever play this character again back when I was in my prime and it would have been good? Because I needed to make movies like Firewall.
Yeah. To be fair, this trend started on the last Indiana Jones movie, which came out like 15 years ago, 14 years ago, where he was elderly. 20
years, 30 years, something like that.
I just love that he's elderly in that film, and now we're getting a 14-year later sequel. Back to Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody. I'm joined by Shane Simmons. And today we're talking about, I didn't really come up with a phrase for this, but I guess...
lame villains.
Yeah, lame villains. There you go. I mean, it's a whole problem. The problem of, and this really only applies to movies where there are good guys and bad guys, like clear-cut good guy, bad guys, in which a hero meets a villain, defeats him decisively early in a movie, and then the filmmakers expect you to still consider that villain to be a reasonable threat. And so many of these films, it just does not work.
Yeah, but when he comes back, he's going to come back strong and angrier. And
I actually have some examples of that at the end, but for the moment, I'm going to stick with them.
Are there some that work?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I tell you what, I will start off right now by giving you an example of one of those that works. It's not the greatest one, but it is a completely acceptable film. Here's a movie in which the villain is defeated quite decisively at the beginning and then comes back. It's called Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes.
Right. Okay.
That movie opens with a pretty good, I mean, actually it's a minor scene compared to the rest of the film, but it's a stage sequence in which Sylvester Stallone soundly defeats evil terrorist Wesley Snipes and gets him arrested, and then his whole life falls apart. They both get put in suspended animation for some reason, and they wake up in the future. And when they wake up in the future, the Wesley Snipes character is essentially imbued with superpowers, but everything the movie does from that point on makes Snipes a credible threat. It's also a very funny movie, like for a violent. Have you ever rewatched this since the early
90s? No, I haven't seen it since back in the day, although I do remember it quite well.
I'm a big fan. It has a script, at least in part, by Dan Waters, the writer of Heathers. So there's a lot of very clever back and forth in this. Some really ridiculous lines too. But
I remember the biggest problem is that when they're frozen, they don't. It's not far enough in the future for the premise to be plausible.
It amused me for what it was. But the character Snipes plays, who's named Simon Phoenix, he fights John Spartan, who's played by Stallone. And after he gets apprehended, frozen, comes back, there is a certain believable level of threat to how they proceed with the story. It's not just a series of, you know, embarrassing defeats that, you know, finally end with end credits.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to get back to another one where I thought showing the character be defeated just took any wind out of the sails of ever saying anything else about this at all. You can argue it any way you want, but I recently saw Justice League, the Snyder Cut, or whatever that's called, Zack Snyder's Justice League, and there was a brand new, very long sequence at the beginning of the film where it is revealed that Darkseid was supposed to be part of this story, and they have a big sequence for how Darkseid once came to Earth, and he had this big plan to dominate and take over, and then they show that, well, the heroes of the time all got together and beat his ass. And you watch the scene, and you're like, yeah, he's clearly losing this fight pretty bad. I've heard the argument. The argument is, well, it took every superpowered being in like the whole world to beat him down. I'm like, but they did. They sent him away with his tail between his legs. Hundreds, if not thousands of years have passed since then, and he's coming back. And then the actual plot of the Justice League movie is, well, it's not Darkseid. It's one of his minor inferior lackeys who comes to Earth. Now let's enjoy 4 entire hours of that character not being threatening. Admittedly, like the dark side was the thing for me where I was like, wow, I just.
Yeah, that whole sequence, it really felt like they were trying to do Lord of the Rings with the defeat of Sauron. And then, he'll be a threat again thousands of years later.
And
it works in Lord of the Rings. It does not work in this film.
So yeah, Justice League, again, another movie where I just say, well, it's the lowest point of the laundry list of complaints I have about it. But I have been as annoyed as I was to sit through the 4-hour Justice League cut and not enjoy any of it. I have been 1,000 times more annoyed to hear the Snyder fans screaming what a triumph this movie is. And also I've heard tons and tons of them say, see, this is what happens when there's no more studio interference and the studio just releases the version he wanted to release. And it's like, the studio didn't release the version he wanted to release. The studio invested another $100 million into a failure of a film. People were angry. They're like, why don't you just release his cut? It's like, it doesn't exist. They have to build it almost from the ground up because he wanted to throw out all of the sequences Joss Whedon finished. And that meant essentially making a new movie with existing footage. But yeah, the attitude that, oh yeah, this movie exactly as it exists now was totally ready to go. No, it wasn't. But yeah, that seems to be the rewritten history now.
Like, yeah, when you have to have a bunch of headliner cast come back to do extensive reshoots just so your film makes sense, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, well, it's just that many, many, many of the sequences that you see in this finished film were not completed at the time that.
Right.
That the
film well, just finishing out. The special effects alone is an enormous cost.
Yeah,
but hey, you know, I guess it worked for HBO Max's streaming service. It's certainly the highest profile streamed movie of the year.
Well, that was kind of why it happened, is that HBO wanted to launch this streaming service. They wanted to get eyes on it. They wanted to get subscribers. And they said, we will gamble $100 million, or I think it's 70 or 100, somewhere in there, to take this very controversial item and bring it to life. I mean, we better get it out there before his masterpiece, Army of the Dead, shows up.
and reminds everyone what a hack he is.
And again, there are plenty of people who think that movie is wonderful.
They are all wrong.
I mean, it must be wonderful. We're getting a prequel any day now, and yeah. a sequel is in the works. And isn't there an animated series? Because who doesn't get sick of the idea of zombies, more zombies, again with the zombies? That should be the title, Again with the Zombies.
I would watch a film called Again with the Zombies.
Oh, there we go. We've got our next project. You heard it here first. We're gonna create this masterpiece, Again with the Zombies. You're right, I'm kind of sold. I like it. Let's do it. I guess I'll move on, unless you have any other bile you want to throw.
Oh, no, but plenty has been said about Justice League.
You don't hate that movie enough for my taste.
I don't hate it as enough. I do. I have much more contempt for Army of the Dead, but
I have much more contempt for Justice League. I did not enjoy Army of the Dead, but
that will be a schism between us forever then.
Yeah, I didn't walk out of Army of the Dead angry, other than, oh, why do I keep wasting my time on this? Whereas with Justice League, I was just so annoyed by how consistently disinteresting it was right to the end.
Well, there is a moment about 4 hours into the film where you start to wonder if you're wasting your time.
Impossible. All right, I'll move on to another topic. I will say, by and large, many of these ineffectual villain things are superhero films, because that's where you get good guy versus bad guy conflicts. But just to mix it up a little bit, I will mention a film that is not superheroes. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Shane, and it's another one that actually inspired me to talk about movies in which a villain is defeated, and then you spend the entire movie saying, are we really supposed to be afraid now that this guy will triumph in the end? So there is a movie from the 90s. I think it's from 95. It was the Clive Barker's follow-up to Hellraiser and Nightbreed. He did a movie called Lord of Illusions. Did you ever see that?
Oh, I think I might have, but it's completely fallen out of my head.
So Lord of Illusions stars Scott Bakula. I just had to pull that from the back of my brain. It was like, what is that guy's name again? And then I did the whole thing of remembering that we all thought his name was Bakula until he said, no, no, rhymes with Dracula.
Scott Bakula. Yeah.
I still remember that.
That still upsets me.
I kind of like it. At any rate, Scott Bakula plays a detective named Harry Lamour, who is hired to look into a strange case, which has a lot of supernatural elements in it. It also features an actor I really like named Kevin J. O'Connor. I'm going completely on memory here. My apologies if I have his name wrong. He's an odd character actor who plays basically a magician of sorts. But when the movie opens, there's a sequence in which Kevin J. O'Connor is trying to go stop essentially a Manson-like cult from sacrificing people. There's a guy who runs this little cult, played by an actor named Daniel Von Bargen, and he plays a cult leader named Nix, N-I-X. And Nix is mildly supernatural, but he's kind of lording over this cult. He's starting to sacrifice people. And Kevin J. O'Connor runs in and attacks Nix while he's essentially in a trance. And they pull out all of this arcane armor and torture devices, and they slap them all on this Nix guy. Like, essentially they're putting him in an Iron Maiden, but they're also grinding things into his fingers. They're trying to totally immobilize him. And it's this very well done, angry, violent sequence where they take down this head of a cult, and then they bury him in this box, so essentially that he cannot use magic to fight back and will be disabled. And they do it. They succeed. They stop him. They bury him. It's over. And then the whole movie, this whole movie of Lord of Illusions, is based upon the premise that that guy's coming back. And you're like, oh, you mean that guy we watched lose at the beginning? That guy who I thought was, I don't know, just an opening sequence character that didn't matter, and we were going to go into a different adventure.
That guy we jumped and put a magical straitjacket on?
Exactly. That's a perfect way of putting it. The fact is, though, the movie does a terrible job of underlining the fact that that guy is coming back, and you should be scared because he was so powerful. They do a terrible job of it. So you watch the majority of the movie going, what is this about? And then at the end, that guy is resurrected, and he is super, super powerful, and they immediately defeat him again. And you're just like, what was this? If the movie did a better job of building the horror at the beginning, it would have worked better. But it is kind of an amazing cautionary tale. I never hear anybody bring it up. Just in terms of storytelling and writing, you're like, if this is your big bad, maybe let us know at some point. So yeah, that's Lord of Illusions by Clive Barker. I don't hate it. It has some very, very upsetting CGI in the middle. I mean, unfortunate CGI, where you're just like, oh, the technology is not there.
Yeah, wrong era for that sort of thing.
Yeah, it looks like the Qbert video game at one point for a few minutes.
Yeah, that era of CG just not age well. Not unless it's like a real AAA production.
And yet The Mummy made, what, $1 billion at the box office when it came out?
Yeah, but it was fun. Yeah, it was genuinely fun.
Awful. It was an awful, awful film. In terms of that specifically, the CGI aspect is so poor that I couldn't take the movie seriously. I know you enjoyed it, and I wanted to. I like the idea of Brendan Fraser playing a minor Indiana Jones knockoff.
Mm-hmm.
I will remind the listener that you're tuned into CJLO 1690 AM, and we are talking about ineffectual villains today. That's our subject. It's a strange topic, but it's one I've always wanted to tackle, at least for one conversation.
Well, I will say it does actually pertain to the Mummy films as well, in that, you know, the first one is like Arnold Vosloo is this all-powerful mummy like you've never seen on a screen before, and they do ultimately defeat him. And then in the second film, what's the villain? Well, it's him again.
Yeah.
It's like, but
that's problematic.
We've already defeated him. It's like, no, I guess we could do it again.
They should have done, it did three Mummy movies, and the third Mummy movie is also, it's a different mummy, I believe.
Yeah,
and I actually liked the third movie. It has a good, it's better made than the first two. It's a different director. It has a better sense of timing and adventure and fun choreography of scenes where they're trying to escape and wheels of a carriage are getting caught and things. But ultimately, it is pretty forgettable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a minor adventure film. But I think you and I discussed this back in 1999. The first movie was The Mummy. So the second movie should have been that character versus Dracula or the Frankenstein's monster or the creature from the Black Lagoon, and just do all the universal monsters one by one.
Yeah. You
could have had a great series of like seven movies.
And they made that exact same mistake with the Van Helsing film, because originally everyone really liked Anthony Hopkins as Van Helsing in the Coppola Dracula film. And there was talk of, oh, maybe Van Helsing should fight other famous monsters.
Right.
And the film was in development hell forever. It finally got made with Hugh Jackman. It's really not related at all. But it's okay, we have Van Helsing and he's going to fight other monsters. Great. Including Dracula. No, the whole point is we've seen Van Helsing fight Dracula in a million different films.
Yeah. And actually, isn't it mainly Dracula? I mean, there's a bunch of other monsters in that.
There's a bunch of others, but yeah, Dracula is the main villain.
Well, and ultimately, it was not a spinoff of the Bram Stoker thing at all.
No, but the idea was, this is Van Helsing, and we're going to finally see him deal with a different problem. But then they second guessed themselves and said, nah, we better have Dracula in this.
And let's also make this a terrible, terrible film.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is absolutely god awful.
There are two things. Actually, since you brought it up, I'm going to bring up two things about the movie Van Helsing.
The same director, too.
Yeah, as The Mummy. Well, he's got a really spotty track record.
I like some of his films.
I think you like less than you think.
I like
Deep Rising.
I like Deep Rising. I was going to say that. True. I like the first Mummy film. Second one, meh, not so much. There's other stuff in his filmography, I'm sure.
The second Mummy movie is also, on top of The Mummy being somewhat ineffectual, it even has a more ineffectual villain in it, which is the Scorpion King.
Oh,
it's going to be such a big deal when that guy gets here. Oh, when he gets here, you're going to see some sparks fly. And then it was this big thing where The Rock is going to play a character in this. And then he shows up and he is 100% CGI.
And the worst CGI of its era.
As far as I know, immediately dispatched. I seem to remember him he shows up and loses. And you're like,
they fight him for a while, whatever. I stopped caring at that point.
But I think it's one scene. And the whole point is, if you kill him, you win. Like it's a some sort of prophecy thing. And they kill him. shows up, they kill him. Then he did a Scorpion King spinoff movie that had nothing to do with it. I actually thought it was a serviceable, mildly entertaining, funny Conan film.
Yeah, it's like Conan the Barbarian type of film. Not
connected to that Mummy movie at all.
But the whole idea is like, oh yeah, root for this guy who becomes this giant supernatural villain. It's like, that there's a disconnect there.
A huge one. Getting back to the superheroes movies where a villain is shown to be ineffectual early on, there is no movie that has ever underlined this premise more, and I know you know this one.
Oh, I'm guessing where you're going.
Then the masterpiece, and I do mean this in so many ways. This movie is a masterpiece of what not to do, and I love this movie for all of its flaws. It is so wrong. Iron Man 2.
Yep, that's the one.
I like a lot of the movie Iron Man 2, and it is very clear when you watch the movie, there is probably 3 or 4 hours worth of footage that they shot for this film usable footage, because there are plot points that drop out of this film suddenly and never return all over the place. There are sequences missing connective tissue where you know they shot scenes and abandoned them. You can, in fact, go to YouTube and watch an entire aborted opening sequence for Iron Man 2, which is totally different than the one that's in the movie now. And I actually prefer the aborted sequence, and you can watch it. It is an unfinished scene. So you see all of the footage, which is Robert Downey Jr. wearing the top half of his Iron Man costume, and the bottom half is leotards with X's all over them. And the first time I saw it, I thought it was a joke. And then I realized, oh, they just never put the money in to finish this.
Right.
They would have CG'd his suit on. It actually opens. If you never seen the scene, Shane?
I don't think so.
It's Tony Stark and Pepper Potts. I was like, what the hell is Gwyneth's name? Pepper Potts. They're on an airplane. They're in the back of an airplane, like a cargo hangar or something in an airplane. Not a hangar, but what would you call the cargo area on an airplane?
The hold.
There you go. They're in the hold of an airplane, and it opens with Tony Stark vomiting because he's been drinking a lot lately. And so he's in his Iron Man suit with his mask off, his helmet off. He's vomiting profusely, and Pepper's checking on him and chastising him, and they have a bunch of banter. And then she says something along the lines of, Tony, you are way too drunk to go out as Iron Man now. And he goes, it's all going to be good. And the back of the plane opens and he just jumps out. And that was this opening scene. I really liked it. It had a strange charm to it. A lot of goofy banter in there. Very Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, well, you know, I still only seen the film the one time, but I enjoyed it because it's a chance to hang out with Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark again, as he deals with his daddy issues. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, there's a villain who's a complete afterthought.
It's unreal to me. I've never seen a film that tried what this movie tries or didn't succeed at, whatever the case is. But so Tony Stark has daddy issues, and he also has, you may not remember this, he has a disease in this movie that is killing him. He has a circuitry-based virus. Something about using armor is making Tony Stark sick. So at the beginning of the movie, they tell you, well, I never quite got over my issues with my dad, and I seem to be a little ill, but a little ill is about the extent of it. He's like, it's like saying, oh, I have this mild rash. So that's Tony Stark's cross to bear in the movie. I don't feel great and mild rash. And then he goes off to fight, essentially to tackle the plot of the film, which is happening completely beneath his notice. The character played by Mickey Rourke, who's a supervillain, he's this guy with electric whips.
Yeah, Whiplash.
Oh, that's actually his name, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Mickey Rourke has this anger towards the Stark Company because they killed his dad or somebody did something to someone, and he's all about the revenge.
Stark Industry has no shortage of disgruntled employees, apparently. Exactly.
So Mickey Rourke is like, I'm going to kill Tony Stark. And then there are scene after scene after scene of Mickey Rourke bragging to people and threatening people about how he's going to kill Tony Stark. It's the only thing he cares about. Meanwhile, we keep cutting back to Robert Downey Jr., who has a mild rash and is completely unaware of Mickey Rourke. So then we get the big set piece scene, which is the racetrack scene. So Tony Stark is at a race for some reason. I forget why. They came up with some reason.
Whatever.
He's driving a car and Whiplash jumps out onto the Formula One racetrack and attacks Tony Stark's car. Tony Stark jumps out, pops his Iron Man suit out of a briefcase. Kind of a great CGI scene, actually, where the suit climbs over his body. And Whiplash is like, Tony Stark, you're going to die because I don't think he even gets it out. Because by the time he said that much, Tony Stark has bitch slapped him so hard, he has already lost the fight and is unconscious. He shows up. He's like, I will kill you. He's like, well, I'm Iron Man. Bang, thud. And essentially, there should be a scene where Iron Man looks around at the audience like, does anybody know what that was about? Despite there being like 40 minutes of build up to this, he's unaware of it.
Yeah, it feels like a day in the life of a superhero where some C-lister rogues gallery guy attacks you. You have a little bit of a fight. It's over. You forget about it. You get on with your day.
So Tony Stark goes back to, oh, my rash and my daddy issues. Completely disinterested in that fight. Meanwhile, we cut to Mickey Rourke, who's in prison now, but plotting his escape and a further, how dare he humiliate me? And you're like, yeah, he really did humiliate you. That was sad. I don't think your view is a threat at all anymore. And so
kind of like the real Mickey Rourke.
Yeah. So we keep seeing scene after scene after scene, like the early scenes where Mickey Rourke is like, well, I'm going to brag about how hard I'm going to kill that guy that he's totally unaware of. And at some point, he escapes from prison, but it is leaked that he has been killed in prison. And someone tells Tony Stark, oh, hey, that guy died in prison. And I believe his reaction is like, who? who are you telling me about? You know, like, oh, that guy who attacked you. Oh, yeah, I'd already forgotten that. The movie continues and he keeps going on about his rash and his daddy issues. And then Mickey Rourke's building this plan. I will murder him. I will murder him. Tony Stark, totally unaware. As far as Iron Man is concerned in this movie, he's not in a movie. He's just, it's a Wednesday. That's Wednesday.
He's trying to figure out why Rhodes looks so different the whole film.
And at some point, Nick Fury shows up and goes, well, Mr. Stark, I need you to join my Avengers team. And he goes, I don't really want to do that. And then he says, well, I do have that cure to your rash. And essentially just goes, here it is. You know, the big plot point, mm-hmm. The only thing you've been trying to do this movie, cure your rash. Well, here's the cure.
Like, yeah, all right. I've brought you your topical cream.
Yeah, it's essentially the sequence. We introduce Black Widow for no particular reason. She has a superfluous fight scene that you watch and go, I don't even understand why this is happening.
That is true. Yeah.
And then
she's slightly more relevant in this film than Hawkeye is in Thor.
Tony Stark turns to Nick Fury during the fight scene, I believe, and says something along the lines of, I want one of those.
Right.
Which is so degrading on like an unbelievable level.
Well, you can see why Scarlett Johansson is suing Disney now. So you've got to burn that bridge.
You do have to burn that bridge. So Tony Stark, for all intents and purposes, I believe, he believes the movie is over. He's completely unaware anything else is going to happen. Enter Mickey Rourke, who's like, I am back and not dead like you all thought I was. To which I believe once again, Robert Downey Jr. goes, who are you? Mickey Rourke says, well, I'm that threat who's been threatening to murder you this whole film. I'm here to take care of it. Here it comes. And Iron Man bitch slaps him and wins the fight in 2 seconds. And I laughed so hard at watching a 2-hour buildup to absolutely nothing. I am, of course,
everyone hates this film, but you're pitching it so well, I really want to watch it again.
I mean, it is not a good movie, but it's all those rules of like, you cannot have a credible villain if the hero isn't even aware of them.
This isn't how one of these works.
Yep. And for that reason, I actually am quite delighted by it. It's a very amusing film. It's the, oh no, my rash bitch slap movie.
The whole thing really does just feel like, oh yeah, okay, I've established myself as Iron Man. And it's not time for the Avengers yet. So let's just watch Tony live his life for a little while.
It is kind of amazing. I am obviously underselling a movie that a lot of people worked very hard on that has other villains and a lot of stakes and all these things, but really it's all about how ineffectual Mickey Rourke's villain is in it for me. I just can't get over
it. On the bright side, the climactic fight, if you can call it a climax at all, does not feature a Marvel hero fighting a bigger, badder version of himself.
Well, thank God they didn't do that in WandaVision either. Oh.
Too bad they didn't do it. Well, our longstanding joke is every Marvel movie ends with them either fighting evil versions of themselves or fighting a lake.
Yes. See the Hulk for the lake. See X-Men 2 for the lake. I think there's several others. Spider-Man 2 for the lake. They do fight a lake at the end. Spider-Man must fight the lake from overtaking the whole city. It is very funny. But yes, and then if that doesn't work, well, you do Spider-Man 3 where he fights Venom, the bigger Spider-Man.
Right.
Or Iron Man 1 where he fights a bigger Iron Man called Iron
Man. Or Ant-Man fighting bigger a little Ant-Man. A bigger little Ant-Man.
Cinema Smackdown on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm Michael Brody. I'm joined by Shane Simmons, and today we're talking about movies with ineffectual villains, bad guys who get defeated early on, keep coming back, and make the audience look around at each other like, didn't we already see this guy lose? Why are we supposed to be worried about him? Examples we gave earlier included Iron Man 2, Logan, Lord of Illusions, and a few others. Here's one that I prepared a whole statement for, so I'd like to read it before we run out of time. One of my favorite, meaning least favorite movies in which this thing happens, is the 2014 Scarlett Johansson movie called Lucy. In Lucy, after Scarlett Johansson gets her superpowers, Choi Min-sik comes after her. Those who don't know who that is, Choi Min-sik is the protagonist of the movie Old Boy. In this movie, he plays a gangster who chases after Lucy and tries to get her. When she acquires powers, she continually defeats him in scene after scene. But he keeps coming after her over and over. And with each attack that he makes on her, it is less and less convincing that she is in any danger whatsoever. But he is the main foe of the film, and so we are constantly being told that he is this dangerous thing that she should be afraid of. However, he is completely beneath her notice for the entire running time of the movie, because she is slowly but surely obtaining godlike powers. So instead of focusing on developing that plot point, they keep trying to make this thing that they make us worried that she's in some sort of danger, despite constantly reassuring us this man is no threat whatsoever. It is the dumbest dynamic, and that is my review of the movie Lucy, which I also like to point out the premise of the movie Lucy is the old standard movie gag of making this statement of the human brain. Humans only use 10% of the brain. What happens when you unlock the other 90%? Now, I've heard that a lot in my life, the premise that humans only use 10%
of their brain. Yeah, and it's BS.
I had it explained to me a really long time ago by someone who was as exasperated as me. And they basically said, okay, this all comes from one test that was done on the human brain like 100 years ago, where the scientist who performed the test said, well, by having a look at brain activity, we've realized that the brain only operates 10% of its mass at a time, but it uses all of it at different times. So the question of what percentage of the human brain do we have access to? It's all of it. It is all of it. We are already at Lucy potential. All right.
Yeah. You mean we're not all just one electrical shock away from becoming a superhero? Damn.
Apparently not. Not in that respect. I mean, you will get electric powers. You will be Electro if you get.
Oh, okay.
So you keep trying.
Well, I prefer to dose myself with radiation. So
a slow but sure, surefire hit.
Yeah, yeah. Those after a while, those gamma particles are yummy.
I got another movie in which the villain is made ineffectual at a certain point. It's actually not at the beginning, but close enough. However, this is not a movie anybody is concerned about the villain's effectiveness, because this movie is called Batman and Robin, in which George Clooney's Batman goes up against Arnold Schwarzenegger's Mr. Freeze, and they have a couple of fights during the film. But very early on, I don't think it's halfway. I think it's earlier than halfway. There is a fight scene where I think he's already met Mr. Freeze once or twice. And then there's this very stylized sequence in which Batman finds out Mr. Freeze is on his way somewhere to commit a crime. And Batman flies in. It's all shot very cleverly. And then Batman flies through like a plate glass window. And Mr. Freeze is on the other side of it. And he kind of throws his arm up like, oh no, I'm being attacked. One of those moments. And the way the film is shot, it cuts from Batman descending on Mr. Freeze to a close-up of Batman's cape as he pulls it over Mr. Freeze's unconscious body, kind of like a bullfighter move. Like,
yes, swoosh, I remember this.
Mm-hmm. And he's out. He's down for the count because Batman has thoroughly defeated him by essentially just punching him in the face. And you're like, well, yeah, that guy's not a threat. You just took him down in a second. And it, again, it's really stylistically filmed, stylized, but you're like,
yeah.
The rest of the movie is like,
but it's really unsatisfying.
Yeah, he breaks out of jail and we got to fight him again. I'm like, just punch him again.
Yeah,
nothing. Well, this
is the film where I believe the villain's master plan was to defeat the hero with puns.
yeah.
You'll notice I laughed as soon as you said Batman and Robin, because there's nothing about that film that isn't funny and stupid.
Exactly. But it is a film where if you even for a moment thought the villain had any threat to him,
If for a moment you thought the Adam West Batman show wasn't campy enough.
Yeah, I can't get over it. Another of my favorite possible examples of ineffectual villains. You know it. I know it. We all know it. The Matrix sequels. The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolutions. So they bring back Agent Smith, who was so utterly defeated in the first film and clearly killed and destroyed forever. But no, mm-hmm. He's back because it's a computer program and therefore it doesn't matter.
And he can make multiples of himself.
Yeah. It doesn't matter appears to be the creator's message to us. But then they say, now look over here and care about where this story is going. But we're like, no, you just said it doesn't matter. Agent Smith is made into one of the major threats for two more Matrix movies. I cannot imagine.
Because you just have to have him around.
Like a more colossal miscalculation. I cannot imagine it. And they literally said, well, we just love this actor. And I'm like, well, I'm glad you love him, but invite him over for dinner. Because making him your antagonist, like, you did it. You made a movie where he was genuinely villainous, creepy, and threatening. And then you have your hero overcome this incredible struggle to utterly defeat him. There is never going to be another scene that works as well as that.
Yeah.
How did no one sit them down and tell them that? Okay.
But you can't run the risk of having to come up with a whole new villain and a whole new actor to play him and hope it's going to work as well. So you just try to recreate the success of the first film.
Well, somehow, some way, they have made a fourth Matrix movie. As of this recording, it is not released.
Well, I can't wait to hear how yet again they brought back Hugo Weaving in some stupid capacity.
The one thing I can tell you is Hugo Weaving is not the villain because
because
he was unavailable. They were considering bringing him back again. It's like, really? I mean, at this point, it's Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner.
Well, can't they get emergency backup Red Skull to fill in as him?
There you go. That's true. That is what he does now. Ross Marquand.
Yeah, hit that guy. Who does amazing voice impressions. But well, you kind of have to bury him under 10 pounds of makeup.
Yeah, he's kind of interesting. Speaking of Ross Marquand and Ross Marquand, that is a tongue-twisting name. Ross Marquand movies, he appears as the Red Skull in another movie I would like to use as an example of somewhat ineffectual villains. And that would be Avengers Endgame. Because we've just gotten through the magnum opus that was Infinity War, in which Thanos defeats everybody. And you're like, wow, he did great. Then Avengers Endgame starts and he's like, oh, hey, guys, I remember you. Remember when I won last year? Well, now I don't care anymore. So they murder him. Mm-hmm. They just murder. He's like, oh, by the way, I'm not a threat anymore. I am murder. So they just murder him. And then the whole movie is like, oh, wait, there's no villain anymore. Let's go back in time and mess up so bad we kind of accidentally bring a version of him back to life.
Right.
Great plan for a movie. And then he shows up and you're like, oh, yeah, that guy we saw you beat at the beginning because gave up.
He is a threat when he comes back again, but apparently all they have to do is wait around for him to become a farmer and then they can decapitate him.
I mean, like I said, that's only a sort of problem movie. It's fine. I don't like Endgame very much.
You only have to wait for Thanos to implement his retirement plan.
Yeah.
Then he's defeatable.
I like to mention this these days that we just had a Black Widow movie that's a prequel sequel to this, in which a major plot point is, hey, did you even notice Black Widow died in Avengers Endgame? Because I didn't. I didn't know she died. I mean, yes, there is a scene in the movie in which she dies, and it is followed by a scene where 100 billion people are resurrected. Where you're like, oh, right. Yeah, but they weren't resurrected the same way that she... I'm like, you just resurrected everyone. I don't care. You cannot make me think at the end of Avengers Endgame, oh yeah, there was that one person who didn't come back. That doesn't work. Nice try. So then having a movie that's all about, oh, we're so sad she's gone. Oh, is she?
All right. Oh, she's gone now, but it's not her sacrifice that killed her off. It was Scarlett Johansson's acrimonious lawsuit against Disney.
Such fun. We have a couple minutes left, so I will point out a couple more movies where they defeat villains, soundly defeat them early on in a movie, and then it kind of works anyway. I don't think you like this example, because I don't think you like this movie at all, even as funny, but Face Off, which I am quite delighted by, is a bad but awesome bad movie.
It's very silly rubbish.
But it does open with a very big set piece sequence in which Nick Cage faces off against John Travolta, and Nick Cage is very soundly defeated in that scene. He is defeated so hard that he doesn't die, but he has massive brain damage and is in a coma, and they say he's never going to wake up. And that's a pretty sound defeat. So, you know, Travolta steals his face to go do one last mission as Nick Cage. And Nick Cage wakes up without a face, and I gotta say, kind of takes back the power in the scene where he doesn't have a face and then convinces a doctor to put his face, another face, back on him. It's a pretty good sequence. And Cage does kind of dance around for that entire film and do good things. So it's not one of the ones where they ruin it by having him lose in the first scene.
Yeah, I'd probably be more satisfied with that film in general if it wasn't one of those John Woo attempts to make an American career films.
Mm-hmm. Another movie in which the villain is resoundingly defeated, and yet you're like, meh, it's okay, is the Star Wars trilogy. In the first Star Wars film, I mean the real first one, everyone, Darth Vader gets defeated at the end of the first movie. It's kind of an embarrassing defeat, too. He's in a spaceship, it gets zapped, and he goes flying off into the distance doing spaceship cartwheels. It looks like he's probably thrown up in his suit pretty good at the end.
He can't throw up with that giant harmonica stuck in his mouth.
I guess not. So, yeah, that's a pretty good example of villains, how they lose, and how they do.
It was a sucker shot by a space pirate. Sign yourself in.